This is People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we return to the second part of our panel discussion on America, where the country's been, where it is now, and a vision for its future. The panel included union activist and member of the National Welfare Rights Union, Sheila Olanaran, Chicago area housing activist Samir Goswani, Midwest Regional Vice President of the Union Unite, Noel Beasley, and student activist Russ Plevachininsky. We'll continue shortly with the comments of our other panel guest, attorney Catherine Crawford, addressing the juvenile justice system. This program was recorded this fall during a benefit for the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, the newspaper of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The benefit was held at the Guild Complex in Chicago, Illinois. The panel discussion was moderated by Laura Garcia, editor of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Here in part two, we return to the comments of attorney Catherine Crawford. In this portion of her comments, Crawford pointed out that when it comes to the criminal justice system, being a person of color and being poor are significant risk factors that lead to being arrested, tried, and convicted. Previously, she had pointed out that police officers are very often stationed at schools that serve primarily minority and poor students. She compares this with schools that serve other clientele.
They do not have police officers at New Trier High School, at least not that I know of. They do not have police officers at Glenbrook South. They do not have police officers in Winnetka and all these schools. If you have police officers there, the likelihood that you're going to be arrested is significantly enhanced because kids are risk takers and kids do things that they're not supposed to do. And I could talk to you for a long time about the frontal lobe and the back lobe because I just learned this great research on how kids think with the back lobe, which is the fight or flight part, whereas adults think with the logic and reason part. So not only are there police in school, which increases your chances of getting arrested, but also kids just walking down the street in certain neighborhoods have a much greater incidence of contact with police officers. When I first became an attorney, and I was still looking at the world with those rosy glasses, I represented this young man who was 17, who was charged with possession of a firearm. And this was his first offense. He was a Latino male, 17, had never been arrested. Okay, that is amazing. Not because male Latino youth tend to commit crimes more often, but they definitely get arrested a lot more often. So the fact that he was 17... and had never been arrested was, I thought, a very great thing. The state's attorney tried to use it against him and said, well, we can't put him on probation because we've never seen how he does. But anyway, so this kid, who was a wonderful kid, he was in adult court because in Illinois, at 17, you're an adult, called me one day and he said, oh, Catherine, man, I got pulled over. And this cop, he said, and I said, well, wait, why'd you get pulled over? And he goes, oh, you know, man, four heads. But anyway, this cop, and I said, well, wait, what do you mean four heads? And he goes, well, you know, if there are four heads in the car, you get pulled over. What are you talking about? Oh, yeah. Okay, so what'd you do? Well, you know, I got out in the back, and I emptied my pockets, and I put my hands on the hood of the car, and I was like, did they tell you to do this? He goes, no, this is just what you do. Because it was routine to him. It was routine for him to be pulled over, to have to empty his pockets, and be subjected to a search. The reason that he was so excited was because when they went through his wallet, the police officer found my business card and said, oh, who's this? And he said, well, I told him that that's my lawyer. And he goes, oh, yeah, I know her. She's a bitch. And apparently my client and all of his friends thought that was really great. And quite frankly, I did too. I don't think the police officer really knew me, but it was pretty exciting stuff. So if you have a higher incidence with police officers, you're going to get arrested more frequently. And it's not just because you might have a little bit of dope in your pocket or you might have something that constitutes a weapon, which is everything nowadays, including fingernail clippers if you're in the right school, but also because they have disorderly conduct. you know, or interference with a police officer. They have all sorts of these interesting little crimes for which you could be arrested. What happens when you're arrested? Well, detention decisions, whether your class and your race factor heavily into whether a judge is going to let you go home while you're awaiting trial or keep you upstairs in the juvenile detention facility. If you have a single mother who works, the judge looks at that as, well, there's nobody to stay home. There's no one to keep an eye on you. You are out after curfew anyway. If you are detained in Chicago and across the nation, if you are detained before trial, the likelihood of you being placed in a residential placement or incarcerated after trial is much higher, because they figure they already have you off of the streets and it's probably better. If you go home and you do well while you're waiting trial, then obviously the likelihood of you being released is much higher. The charging decisions are very discriminatory. And I'm just, in the few minutes I have, few seconds I have left, I'll just tell you about one law that I think really represents the racism that is pervasive in the juvenile and criminal justice system. We have automatic transfer laws in Illinois where there's a juvenile court and the adult court, and the juvenile court is a very serious place and you can get incarcerated for a long time, but you get released when you're 21, and that's very important. And you don't have and your record supposedly is sealed, although we're really, really trying hard to make these convictions follow children. And the goal is supposed to be rehabilitation. So the difference between juvenile and adult court is significant. Adult court, there's no rehabilitative goals. You can get up to life in prison. You are incarcerated with adults as soon as you turn 18, which means that you are much more likely to be victimized while you're awaiting, while you're serving your sentence. And you have a felony conviction, which means that you can't get a job or vote. So we have these automatic transfer laws that say if you commit certain offenses as a juvenile, you're automatically going to adult court. No judge is going to decide if it's better or worse for you. You're automatically going. Things like murder, okay, I mean, actually, there's some arguments for not having automatic transfer for murder, but 15 years old, automatic transfer. But possession of drugs within 1,000 feet of a school or public housing is an automatically transferable offense. Between 1995 and 1999, when that law went into effect, 363 youth were prosecuted under the automatic transfer laws. 99.2%, I can't figure out what this 2% is, were minorities. 99.2% of everybody in the state of Illinois that was prosecuted under the automatic transfer laws were minorities. 99.2% of those kids that went to adult court. Half of them were found guilty. 65% were sentenced to probation. 10% were sent to boot camp. And 14% were sent to the Illinois Department of Corrections. The problem with that is obvious. One, it's a very racist law. Because why would it be 99%? Because if you live in the city of Chicago on the south side, you're within 1,000 feet of either a school or public housing. You cannot go anywhere without being within 1,000 feet of a school or public housing. Is there hope? I could talk to you for days about the various different criminalization of our youth and the way that we are afraid of them. But I don't think that it's hopeless, because I work with these youth, and one of the things that is so gratifying to me is that there are so many opportunities for youth to be empowered these days. We're starting with peer juries at schools. There are community panels for youth, which involve the kids in the community instead of the courts when they go to have offenses. There's a group called Youth First. There's even things like Young Chicago Authors, which helps kids sort of develop and discover their artistic abilities. So I think that there is hope. And the one thing that I would ask of you, because I don't see a lot of youth, you're not all old or anything, but I think it's really important to, instead of looking away when you see that teenager or walking on the other side of the street or hurrying up in your car, to look them in the eye and be an adult and embrace them and don't fear them, because the youth, they are so fabulous and so much more interesting than adults, I have to tell you. So that's my challenge to you.
Thank you, Catherine. I think one of the things to respect, to think about, is that we gotta respect our youth. Our youth is our future, and without them, we have no future. So with that, I would like to introduce Russ.
Well, I'm a student at Loyola University Chicago, and I've been an anti-sweatshop activist for about 3 years. And while I've mostly focused on labor issues in my work, tonight I would like to talk more about how our educational system shapes the way we view America. Because we don't just learn about biology and psychology and the other social sciences in school, but I think we're also fed a certain ideology. And this ideology, to me, is very individualistic and also very consumer-oriented. The Loyola chapter of Students Against Sweatshops has frequently demonstrated several times at stores all across Michigan Avenue, from Disney Store to Nike Town. And if y'all have been to Michigan Avenue, y'all pretty much know that the people who shop there don't really have a reputation for being very approachable or very friendly, and usually they're just pretty rude. So one of the common responses that we always get is, why don't you get a job? Well, I have two jobs. Three if you count being a full-time student. And yet I still manage to find myself out here on Michigan Avenue demonstrating against sweatshop abuses. So this response of go out and get a job doesn't really make much sense to me. But if you look at our educational system, this response of why do you get a job begins to make some sense. I remember when I was in high school, I was told to study hard and get good grades so that I could get into a good college and go get a good job. And then when I was in college, I was told you could pick whatever major you want, but I was advised to pick a business-friendly major so that I could get a good job and make lots of money. And now that I'll be graduating this year, hopefully, I'm always asked, what kind of job would I want after school, and am I looking forward to making lots of money? So... So in school, I think that basically we're taught that the end game is simply to get a job and make a lot of money. And the idea of questioning things, such as, I don't know, how multinational corporations behave in the world, and how working conditions and about working conditions both here and abroad, is not really stressed as much as the need to find a job and make a lot of money. So that is the America that I see, an America where we are taught to find the job for ourselves and make money, and we are not really taught to question how the world works or what can be done about it. Basically, we're taught to be consumers, and we're not taught to ask questions. So the America that I want to see is just the opposite. An America where we do question where our products come from, what conditions they're made in, and how people are treated in our global economy. So who are the faces behind these clothes? Or the food that we're eating tonight? And United Students Against Sweatshops has been pressuring our universities to ask these questions about where our products are made and how our workers are treated. Students across the country have been demanding university bookstores to sell union-made clothing, and they have also done many successful living wage campaigns for university workers, including the very successful Harvard Living Wage campaign about 2 years ago that culminated in a three-week sit-in of the president's office building. It was really cool. They have a video called Occupation. It's a 45-minute video. It's great. They made it in their basement. It's really good. So I would like to see an America of educated consumers that see the faces behind the products we consume. And to do this, I think we need to break down the barriers between rich and poor, first world and third world, and consumer and producer. United Students Against Sweatshops has been building partnerships with workers all over the world, working together in the struggle for workers' rights and economic justice. But this struggle will never be won until we as consumers start asking these questions so that our everyday consumption does not consume the poor. And that is the America that I would like to see.
The final speaker on the panel is Noel Beasley, Midwest Regional Vice President for the Union Unite.
As a trade unionist, along with a lot of my friends and colleagues in the room here tonight, I spend a lot of my time working with contracts, labor contracts in particular. And I'd like to talk a little bit about our country tonight in terms of the social contract that we have with our government. And our social contract, of course, is the U.S. Constitution. And I think we can effectively argue on the basis of everything we've heard from the panel so far and our own experiences that we've got a situation of serious breach of contract in our country right now. And we see this by the many assaults in many forms being made on our basic democratic system. And I'd like to just give four brief examples of this. There are many, many others we could cite. Example number one would be the narrow definition of politics, which would be electoral politics. And the old adage about first time tragedy, second time farce was played out in Florida in the last couple of weeks once again, We had the tragic presidential election and selection process of 2000, and most recently the former Attorney General of the United States couldn't even vote. Janet Reno, it took her 45 minutes to be able to allow to vote for herself in an election in Florida. So it's clear to us, I think, that without those Cuban and Haitian advisors and election judges and observers that Fidel offered in 2000, we're never going to have free elections in the state of Florida. There's no question about that. Example number two occurred just within the last couple of days and has been referenced by other speakers here tonight. The Congress of the United States, theoretically, and I'm going to stress theoretically here, is elected to represent us as the people. And this group that was represented to elect us has just voted away their historical power to declare war. And they had that power because they were there as our delegates, and they were going to declare war on behalf of those who would fight it and those who would pay for it. And I use pay in the broadest sense of the word, of paying for something. And thus, the Congress that we elected has tacitly torn up a large section of our contract, of our Constitution. It's as though a group of trade unionists were to walk into a room with employers and take a piece out of the contract and rip it into shreds and throw it up in the air. And that's what the United States Congress just did to our contract. The example that I would cite as number three has to do with this whole question of what's happened to our basic Bill of Rights in the last year or so since the events of September 11th and those events both before and after them. I used to be very fond of quoting the Neville brothers, who in one of their songs sing freedom of speech as long as you don't say too much. But I've decided that really that's not the situation that we're in now and have not been in for the last year. The situation right now has regressed to the point where the appropriate slogan is freedom of speech as long as you spend enough, because that's the corporate ownership of the media that Laura referenced in her opening remarks and the controlling of the mass media that shapes so much of how some people think. I'm going to argue here in a couple of minutes, though, that it's difficult for any mass media to shape a form of opinion for people when their version of what's going on is so much at odds and so clearly at odds with the practical daily experiences of the people that they're trying to manipulate. Example number four would be this most recent reversal of law that just occurred on the west coast of California, with the President of the United States invoking his Taft-Hartley rights to end a phony lockout in an attempt to bust one of the most important and powerful unions in the United States, the Longshore Workers Union of the West Coast. The Taft-Hartley Act and its power to order workers back to work in a state of national emergency has only been used by presidents 32 times since it was enacted in the late 1940s. And this is the first time, and it won't be, I will argue, the last time, that it's been used to end a lockout. The purpose of it was to end strikes in situations in which the national welfare or the economy of the country was at risk. This is a classic example of manipulation in which the employers lock out a group of workers who want to continue to work and negotiate their contract, who are working to rule a time-honored labor technique to use in periods of difficulty with employers. A phony lockout followed in very short order by the President of the United States manipulating the Taft-Hartley Act to force the workers to go back to work. These are just four examples of the breach of contract that we have, and I think as these examples pile up, it's pretty clear that the contract has been more than breached, that our contract with our country and our government in particular has been fundamentally broken. Other speakers have referenced the fundamental drives of the American Revolution, which were and have been those of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But right now we have leadership in this country, political leadership, elected leadership, or selected leadership, who have now structured these basic rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as privileges to be purchased rather than as rights which must be guaranteed. The purpose of a government is to guarantee life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Our governments, in the most recent period of time, have twisted that so that their role is to sell these basic fundamental rights as privileges. So I think you would agree with me that it's probably time to negotiate a new contract, time to negotiate a new social contract. There are basic provisions in contracts, in all contracts, that need to be respected. And I'd like to cite a few sample provisions of the contract that we think we should negotiate. First of all, there's this whole question of hours of work. In our contracts, we define hours of work. We define what the work week is. We define when you get regular pay and when you get overtime pay. This country is rapidly degenerating into two groups, those who are overemployed and those who are unemployed. And we're going to have to negotiate this whole issue again of the right to a job, but the kind of job that guarantees that you also have a right to a full life. The second is the question of wages. In all of our contracts, we spell out the issue of wages, what your classification should pay. And as you all know, there's been a very important movement in this country that's been gaining a lot of momentum and a lot of steam, and justifiably so, to fight town by town, city by city, state by state, for what's called a living wage. No one can live on the ridiculous and preposterous minimum wage that's in place in the country right now. That's why people have their two and three jobs. But we've got to renegotiate wages, and ultimately we've got to eliminate wages, because that will not be the long-term solution to providing for the needs of people. Then there's this question of health care, which has already been talked about very eloquently. I will just stress the fact that we've worked very hard in our union in the last couple of years to stop talking about health insurance and to start talking about health care. Most of our contracts deal with health insurance, what you're supposed to pay and what benefits you're supposed to receive in relationship to what you pay. It's time to move beyond that question of insurance, since we know that there is no insurance. When 44 million people have no access to insurance, fundamentally because their jobs either do not provide it or they have no jobs with which to provide it, then health insurance no longer can be the core issue. The question of health care for all is the issue. All of our contracts deal in one form or another with the question of education and training. The state of Illinois just increased the tuition across the state in state universities and colleges by 30%. I was shocked to learn that no workers that I work with received 30% wage increases in that same period of time. And the denial of access to education, public or private, is a major shift in our country in the last 50 or 60 years. And we're going to have to renegotiate the terms and conditions of education and training in our society. We can't negotiate pensions anymore. The ugly secrets about the stock market have now been exposed. And whether you were in a 401k that became a 201k and then became a 101k and then became a half a K, or you were in a defined benefit plan that still had the majority of its assets invested in that stock market, the whole question of a pension or a guaranteed income after you retire, if indeed you're fortunate enough to live so long, has been exposed for the mythology that it always was. We cannot continue to negotiate on the question of retirement pensions. We have to negotiate on retirement security, which means that there's a network around you that guarantees that you can have the dignity that you're entitled to when you advance to the status of senior citizen. Health and safety, our contracts have these provisions. Workers are dying by the tens of thousands. Somehow or another, in all of the publicity about the longshore workers and their alleged slowdown, it was most of the media neglected to point out how many workers have died on the job in those West Coast docks. But that question of health and safety, which is so minimalized by corporate America, is one that we have to refight and renegotiate again. No discrimination clauses. You look at the labor contracts of the 40s and 50s, you will find spelled out, literally, men's jobs and women's jobs. They're broken apart in the back of the contract, so that there's one, and they're for the same jobs, by the way. There's wage scales for men and there are wage scales for women. What you don't see in those pages, because nobody would have even bothered to think about it then, is that you don't see black jobs and white jobs. You don't see brown jobs and white jobs. But we are rapidly now returning to a system of government in this country where whether it says it in the contract or not, that's what there are. There are brown jobs and black jobs and white jobs and men's jobs and women's jobs and all of those struggles of the latter part of the 20th century. There's now a ferocious attempt to try to reverse all of those things that were won. And finally, no contract is complete without a grievance procedure. And it occurs to many of us, I think, that our grievance machinery is broken down. And the number of individuals whose lives have been fundamentally destroyed by an injustice system that prevails in this country right now means that we need a different kind of grievance procedure. And I would pose to you that there's no better form of a grievance procedure than a people's tribunal. We've had a lot of discussion about the crisis, and all of us, I think, on this panel certainly have a feeling of hope, or we wouldn't be here. We'd be doing something else tonight if we didn't see the basis for hope. But certainly it comes down to that broad banner umbrella word that we always use in these kinds of situations, and that is that the best preparation for negotiations is to organize, and in this particular situation, to organize for greater political power. And we have to do that, first of all, by projecting this vision of hope that is based on the fact that this hope will come out of struggle. It will not, nothing will be handed to us, nothing will be passive. Only by being active, only by being militant in the most profound sense, and only by aggressively leading fights will these trends be reversed. A lot of us have concluded that the Labor Party is a place and an appropriate vehicle to conduct that fight. A lot of the themes that we're talking about here tonight are deeply embedded in the platform of the Labor Party. There's a genuine urgency right now, but it's not an urgency based on the prospects of defeat and loss, even though those are serious and dynamic, and we have to be very, very careful not to underestimate how fraught with danger this situation is. But at the same time, and not by coincidence, at that very same time, there's also never been a better time to lead a fight based in the working class of this country against those elements that we've been warring with since the country was created. There's never been a better time because, frankly, back to that back lobe again, there's never been a better time to fight, and there are no avenues for flight left. This is not a fight we can run away from. We will either be victorious in this fight, which I believe we will, or we will be decimated in this fight. There can be no hope without the truth. The truth is the only bulldozer that creates the highways that will lead us out of the dilemmas that we're in. And on that basis, with those truths and with those fundamental facts, we can renegotiate this contract. We can have a far better contract than we've ever had before. And I'm looking forward to that round of negotiations with you.
That's the end of part two and our panel discussion on America, where we've been, where we are, and a vision for the country's future. Thanks to all of our panel participants, moderator Laura Garcia and the Guild Complex for hosting the event. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with social and economic justice for all. If you'd like more information about the League, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the internet, www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.